Stephen, Dr. Zunis, welcome to Gaza Corner, and sorry for the late start, but I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, no problem. Good to be with you.
Yeah, Dr. Stephen Zunis is the professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. 29 years Dr. Zunis has been there. He's the founding director of the program in Middle Eastern Studies and really one of the go-to guys when it comes to discussing U.S. Middle Eastern policy, also a advocate for strategic nonviolent action, has served as the senior policy analyst for foreign policy and focus project of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an associate editor of Peace Review, and until June of this year was a contributing editor of Tikkun. I know you've been extremely busy since the election, particularly. Did it catch you by surprise that Trump won? And secondly, what do you think the ramifications are for the Middle East?
I was actually surprised, certainly at the extent of the victory. I, to be honest, I really had more faith in the American people. I mean, not only the policies are very, very dangerous on so many levels, you know, but his own competence and character and things like that, and what people go to not have a female president.
Do you really think that was the key issue?
No. I mean, that certainly. I mean, whenever you get some incompetent white guy to take a job, you know, that could go to a much, much more competent black woman, you got to expect that racism and sexism is part of the equation. And I think that there, and of course, many people on the left were alienated, you know, by the supporting the genocidal wars in the Middle East. Though I was one of those who argued that the evidence was pretty strong that Harris would have been much, not nearly as bad as Biden, but that she was constrained by the fact that she was the sitting vice president. And so she ended up in a situation like Hubert Humphrey in 1968, you know, when many anti-war people refused to vote for him because he was Johnson's vice president, even though in hindsight, he would have ended the war much, much sooner than Nixon did.
Why do you say the evidence was, you know, strong that she would have departed from Biden's policy?
Oh, you know, the number of issues. One is that, you know, she was the first person in the administration to call for a ceasefire. She's been the most outspoken person in the administration in terms of raising concerns about civilian casualties. Now you'd say, well, you know, what's the point? Because the arms are still flowing, but she wasn't the one making that decision. It was already enshrined in the Democratic platform before she even became the nominee. And it would be seen as disloyal or divisive to our sitting vice president to split on a major policy issue, particularly one involving foreign affairs. Also, if you look at the people around her, including Philip Gordon, her chief foreign policy advisor, he's not progressive, but he was a pragmatic internationalist. He's been willing to criticize Israel, and there've been no less than a half dozen articles from the Washington Post, Politico, and other journalistic services in the D.C. area that has reported that she, along with Secretary of Defense Austin and CIA Director Burns, are among the three who are pushing unsuccessfully for Biden to crack down on Netanyahu. And also just some personal contacts I have in D.C. have confirmed that as well. Now, that doesn't mean it's a moot point at this around here at this point, but still, that gave me had given me hope, but we'll never get to see. And most, I mean, I think she might have been able to end the killing sooner. But in terms of actually allowing for a viable Palestinian state or a binational state or, you know, any kind of real peace settlement, she would have probably been similar to Obama in that he said the right things and quietly did do things to constrain Netanyahu on some areas, but wouldn't put in what it took to actually bring peace and justice to the region.
You know, I would just take issue with the fact that she had a chance, and this was not going to cost her politically, to have a Palestinian American speak at the National Convention, the Democratic National Convention. And from all that I've read, maybe you know better than I do, it was her decision to not have a Palestinian American speak.
That was a very bad move, and I was very highly critical of it at the time. And I really don't know what her thinking was around that. I think the people, so many people in D.C. think we're still in this era where you can go as far as the right on the right on Israel Palestine as you can get, and it won't hurt you politically. They're concerned with a relatively small group, and I think it is exaggerated in terms of its size and influence of Zionist Jews for whom this would make the difference in terms of whether they vote Democratic or Republican, or if they wrote a check for the campaign or whatever. And the thing is very different now. This is hurting them politically. I mean, 80% of Democrats, two-thirds of the American people as a whole, 80% of Democrats support conditioning military aid to Israel. I mean, and the polls showed that if she did take that position, it would not have hurt that much. In fact, it would have probably helped. In fact, as much as a third of the support for Jill Stein or those who just left or otherwise did not vote for Harris, they would have done so. They would have reconsidered. That may not make a difference last Tuesday, but it certainly was a factor. And we're in a different era now, but I think official Washington hasn't gotten the memo.
Let's move to the fact that Trump is going to be the president. And I mean, if you were Palestinian, you might have every right to think it doesn't make any difference. I mean, what can be worse than the fact that the Biden administration enabled a genocide? Mm-hmm. And not just in Gaza, but what's going on in the West Bank. And from what I've read, also, the Biden administration green-lighted Israel's invasion of Lebanon, although with Israel and Netanyahu, I'm not so sure we're at a point where they need a green light from the United States. It seems like they'll do what they want. I don't know in terms of Iran. We can discuss that later. But what would you say what do you think the consequences of Trump being president means for Gaza, for the West Bank, for Lebanon, for Iran, however you want to attack it?
I think the killing is going to continue. No way Trump is going to put any real pressure on Netanyahu. I think the biggest difference is what's going to happen afterwards. That I think that Trump people would green light outright annexation of the West Bank, as well as northern Gaza and perhaps more, or some kind of semi-permanent Israeli occupation of South Lebanon again, and the United States will be even more of an outlier in terms of the international community than it has under Biden. But the flip side of that is I think it will provide opportunity for the movement, a pro-Palestinian movement, or simply the peace and human rights and anti-occupation movement, to get a lot more support, because it's always hard to challenge a Democratic president. That a lot of liberals get kind of nervous, and saying, "Oh, don't criticize Biden. Don't call it genocide. It's going to hurt the Democrats' re-election chances, and we'll get Trump." Well, with that not the issue now. And the fact that it's Trump that's supporting genocide instead of a Democrat, I think there'll be a lot more opposition, and a lot of these politicians who have been very frustratingly slow at calling for ceasefire, who still haven't taken a stance against military aid. I mean, these people, are going to be pressed, saying, "Are you going to follow the policies of the Trump administration, or those but polls show an overwhelming majority of your constituents?"
I think that. One difference is just rhetorical. I mean, Biden didn't quite show the rhetorical empathy that Harris does, but Netanyahu played Biden like a fiddle. And, I think that Netanyahu thought that he could make the difference in the election. As it turned out, the size of Trump's win, overwhelmed the Arab American issue,
yeah.
But But when Trump was president from 2016 to 2020, he basically just said, do whatever you want. And he has said on the campaign trail now, just get it over, you know, just do it, but do it quickly, you know, just get it done. And I don't know what that looks like. Apparently, there is no end game. Netanyahu has seen not having an end game as a way of preserving himself in power. And now, unless you correct me, he's more popular now than he's been in years because of what he's been able to accomplish in assassinating the hierarchy of Hezbollah and Hamas and you know, the Israelis really don't see what's going on in Gaza the way we do.
That's true. But I would say that he's not he's still not popular. He would still likely lose an election, but he did get a bounce, to be sure. He never got the post disaster bounce like Bush did with 9/11 because his security failings were still obvious. But as the war dragged on, things got worse. But now that they can cite some tactical victories, you know, again, he's getting some support. But I really don't think it's a matter of playing Biden like a fiddle. I think, you know, Biden was quite willing to go along with this. Remember, this is the same Joe Biden that, you know, supported U.S. intervention in Central America. This is the same Joe Biden that supported the invasion of Iraq. He's always been on the hawkish wing of the Democratic Party. And he is really a true believer when it comes to Israel. I mean, he is of that immediate post-war generation that, you know, idolizes Israel. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the old, you know, communists of the 1930s, you know, who did some really good, important work on labor rights and civil rights and everything, but really believed that Uncle Joe Stalin was the best thing ever, and all the negative things being told about him were propaganda, and that's sort of how Biden views Israel. So, I think he was singularly the worst person to have been a Democrat of national stature to have been president. No way would a Sanders or a Warren or even a Buttigieg or some of these others would have allowed this to happen.
But don't you think that? I mean, I agree with you in terms of how Biden views Israel, but it seemed to me that he was genuinely angry at Netanyahu for not being able to have a ceasefire when it seemed that the war goals were all accomplished.
And also that would
help him obviously in the election if he got a ceasefire.
But again, he clearly didn't feel strongly enough about it to actually do anything about it. I mean, this is the United States. I mean, I really, really think if this is not a tail wagging the dog situation. You know, Eisenhower forced the Israelis out of Gaza in 1956-57. Carter forced a withdrawal of Israeli troops from most of Lebanon in 1978 after that invasion. Reagan did the same thing in 1982-83. Obama on two occasions stopped Israeli offensives in Gaza. And in each of these cases, you know, they apparently did include threats on withholding military aid. So the United States does have the power, but Biden chose not to use it. And the difference is that Trump will not be even giving the verbal criticisms, but essentially a blank check for Israel to do what it wants.
So let me ask you about Iran, because I think Biden did put his foot down, perhaps, when it came to Iran. And why, even though there was all this, you know, tit for tat and you know, back and forth between Iran and Israel, and also, you know, using surrogates, Israel did not, you know, go all out in attacking, you know, nuclear facilities or anything that really could have been over the top, that really would have gotten a response from Iran in a very serious way. Mm-hmm. And so I think maybe that was something that where Biden did use leverage. With Trump, What do you think? I mean,
Yeah. Well, no, there'd be no holding back. I mean, I think, but well, in certain respects, but who knows? I mean, in the case of Biden, what it came down to was the fear that if there, that if it was a major attack that included nuclear oil installations, other things, that America, it could lead to a suspension of shipping on the Persian Gulf, which would, you know, sent oil prices skyrocketing. The American troops in Syria and Iraq, where there are a pro-Iranian militia, and as well as along the in Jordan, along the borders, they become very, very vulnerable. So I think he was doing this to protect U.S. interests. He obviously doesn't care how many Palestinians and Lebanese die. Trump, you know, there are a couple of really nasty incidents with Iran when he could have pulled the trigger. In fact, the Democratic platform ironically criticized him for not responding more strongly. But he didn't want to risk American troops either. And I think that he seems to be kind of sensitive about that. He'll let proxies do all sorts of horrible things, but he doesn't, even more so than Biden would. But I find feeling he would, he might be willing, might hold back. But at the same time, the risk is very high because of his rhetoric, because of his obsession with Iran, the fact that he's very close to both the Israelis and the Saudis and the Emiratis, you know, who all are obsessing over Iran. So, again, I think he may indeed not hold Israel back. So we'll see what happens.
What about the move to finally fire Gallant as the defense minister? I hate even calling it defense. Why don't they just call it, you know, Secretary of War like we used to?
But yeah, I mean he's in soon to be indicted war criminal like Netanyahu, but apparently was not right enough for him. I mean, you know, a lot of people in the brass in Israel, you know, are more practical. I mean, again, they may be war criminals, you know, but they think strategically, whereas Netanyahu is an ideologue. I mean, the 2006 invasion of Lebanon, which was a huge humanitarian disaster, like this one, But you know, at that point, the Israelis attempted a larger ground invasion that ended up being really, really disastrous, and Hezbollah was able to get more rockets off and do more damage within Israel itself. But the general staff did not want to do that. They were goaded by the Bush administration, who wanted to basically neutralize an Iranian ally so the U.S. could go after Iran later, and so. And the generals, and in fact, the U.S. wanted them to attack Syria as well, but the Israeli general said no way. And the Winogrand report, which followed the war, was rather revealing, and that it did show what a stupid mistake it was and how it was done over the best wishes of the people who knew the most.
That's the voice of Dr. Stephen Zunis, our guest on Gaza Corner. He's the professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, and he's the founding director of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. So the new defense minister is Israel Katz. He's known as an ultra hawk when it comes to Iran. He's been one of these guys who talks about Iran smuggling weapons through Jordan to Hamas, which is completely unfounded. And you know, what's your thought about Israel?
Oh, that's nuts. I mean, Iran definitely has proxies and allies throughout the region. I mean, the militia in Iraq and in Syria pretty much speak directly to the folks in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. The Houthis have gotten more substantial, has gotten some substantial Iranian support, but they are their own group with their own history, with their own agency. And Hezbollah, Iran had a major role in their founding and in supporting them over the years. But they also have a very strong base within the Lebanese Shia community. So all those places Oh, these groups do have some fairly close ties to Iran to varying degrees. Hamas, much less so. They never gave them the really sophisticated missiles. They gave Hezbollah both because logistically it'd be virtually impossible, but also that there are some real differences in the two groups. In fact, they were Hamas and the Iranians were on opposite sides during the Syrian civil war. They were pretty bitter at each other. Islamic Jihad was the favored Palestinian group as far as the Iranians were concerned, but they were fairly small, and again, there wasn't that much substantial aid. So, I mean, this whole thing about trying to portray them as a proxy is a disingenuous effort to provoke war with Iran.
Right, and that's that. But that's the that could be Israel Katz's agenda, and I don't know if it's
Yeah.
Netanyahu's.
Oh, yeah. Of course, people are gonna say that. I mean, people say that Iran is supporting the Polisario Front in Western Sahara, and that is absolutely nuts. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence, nothing, that kind of linkage. And Polisario is a secular, left-leaning group. They are nothing, and they're Sunni. And in fact, they practice a liberal brand of Maliki jurisprudence. So it's like, they're the last people to ally with Iran or Hezbollah. But people say that kind of stuff anyway.
Yeah, and that was the last act by Trump before he left office was to recognize Morocco's annexation of the Western Sahara. Of course, Trump also moved the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, closed the Palestinian consulate in Washington, D.C., also ended funding to UNRWA, and Biden reinstated it shortly after being elected in 2020. But let me ask you about UNRWA, which why don't you explain the origins of UNRWA and how absolutely essential UNRWA has been as basically a government in Gaza to assist to feed and provide all kinds of humanitarian aid to the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and elsewhere, but particularly in Gaza. And now Israel says that they are closing UNRWA down, which, I mean, where does that leave us?
It's definitely going to, there'll be some other charities and various groups that will can meet some of the demand, but not most of it. It's going to really, really, really hurt. I mean, the United Nations Works Relief Association, UNRWA, was founded immediately after the Nakba, as a means of helping the Palestinian refugee population. Their major presence in Gaza, which the majority of the residents of the Gaza Strip are refugees and their descendants. UNRWA also works in the West Bank, both in areas under the nominal control of the Palestine Authority as well as those under Israeli control. And they operate in Jordan and Syria and Lebanon as well. But when the Israeli government, without evidence, claimed that their 14 UNRWA employees took part in the October 7th terrorist attacks,
Out of 30,000 employees.
Out of 30,000 employees in all these areas, the Biden administration and initially some other governments cut off all funding. Well, after investigations reveal there really wasn't much to these claims, and certainly UNRWA itself shouldn't be blamed, all the countries that had suspended funding resumed it, except for the United States. In fact, it's been codified by an overwhelming bipartisan majority of Congress that prohibits U.S. funding. So even if a president wanted to restore it, they'd now have to go through Congress, and Congress has been clear they're not going to support them. Now, UNRWA, like all UN agencies, is paid by contributions from member states, and the United States being the largest country in terms of GNP with the United Nations gives the largest chunk. So the U.S. gives about 20% of UNRWA's budget. So the U.S. cutoff of, one-fifth the budget when their needs are obviously higher than ever, was a major blow to their humanitarian work. And now with Israel controlling their movement and what they can do in terms of getting in and out of Gaza or the West Bank or other areas under Israeli control, is obviously going to make things even worse.
And the State Department, I mean, this is such a contradiction. So you have Congress that puts a 2-year freeze on funding UNRWA, but the Biden State Department said that you can't replace UNRWA. You just can't.
Well, there have been agencies in the State Department dealing with humanitarian affairs and human rights and arms control and a number of other things have written very critical reports saying that the U.S. should suspend, has legal grounds for suspending military aid, that there's this desperate humanitarian need, that the U.S. could play a major role in making sure it gets to the people who need it. But in each case, Secretary of State Blinken has overruled them. And because, of course, the State Department, like other government agencies, does have a civil service and a political civil service that serves under both Republican and Democratic administrations, and they have Middle East Division where a lot of people speak Arabic and know something about the region, and you have people who work at these agencies dealing with humanitarian affairs and human rights and labor rights and environmental issues and things who are quite good at trying to put these principles as a major thrust of U.S. foreign policy as U.S. laws in some cases actually require. We not only we're going towards a situation where we've had what we've had up to this point, where up to this point we've had Biden that says, "Well, you guys can issue these reports and say the stuff, but we'll ignore you." But now Trump is promising to basically politicize the entire State Department apparatus, firing the Middle East experts. And bringing in these right-wing Christian nationalists and other really far-right Zionist folks who will make it even impossible to issue a decent human rights report every year or whatever. That'll totally get politicized into the agenda of Trump and Jared Kushner and the right-wing Christian nationalists and the others. Who will who are supporting Netanyahu and his takeover of all of Palestine and more?
I want to drill down a little bit on northern Gaza right now. I mean, it seems to me, like for example, when I listen to All Things Considered or Morning Edition, and it just seems that there's less coverage of Gaza now, and there may be mainstream media Gaza fatigue setting in. At a time when, in especially North Gaza, very few people really know what's going on because if you're a journalist in North Gaza, you're targeted and killed, essentially. And the killing in North Gaza and the absolute annihilation of any kind of living space, I'd like you to just, share whatever you may know that is the mainstream media is not talking about, because this genocide is not just about killing. And The Lancet has said that, when they say like 44,000 Palestinians have been killed, those are bodies that they've been able to recover from the rubble and have been documented. The Lancet said it could be closer to 200,000 in terms of indirect deaths. And we're talking starvation, we're talking disease, obviously also all kinds of cultural erasure. And in northern Gaza, it seems now the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have said Palestinians are not even allowed to go back to their homes in North Gaza. So that is the very definition of ethnic cleansing. And the fear is that Israel will occupy North Gaza and maybe bring, settlers in there. What are your thoughts about what's happening, not just in Gaza, but in North Gaza in particular?
Well, you described the situation pretty well. I mean, the photographs that have come out of there have been shocking in terms of the, I mean, the rubble. I mean, it's just, they're, you know, this really is ethnic cleansing, and the humanitarian situation. Everything is just getting worse and worse every day. 32 people were killed, you know, just in the past day alone, outright from bombs, not to mention the growing death toll from the famine that is spreading. I mean, I think the main reason, of course, that Gaza's kind of dropped off the map in terms of mainstream American media coverage is that everybody's been focusing on the election in the final weeks. And of course, now with the shocking results and analysis, and now it's going to shift to, you know, the really scary plans that Trump has for appointing people to various positions and the policies he's going to pursue. And there'll be more coverage about the one outrage after the other. And it's going to be really hard to keep up with it all. And so I'm afraid Gaza will not resume to the prominence than they have had earlier.
But at the same time, the news of what's being described as an anti-Semitic attack in Amsterdam during a football game, we call it soccer, which actually started with the burning of a Palestinian flag and a Palestinian taxi driver being attacked, which is definitely not being talked about very much in the media. But that story was all over headlines everywhere in mainstream media. Yeah. And yet,
and it happened in Europe, and where there are reporters and they had footage and the kind of thing where the media is denied outright in Gaza. I'm sorry, but let me interject two things before I forget. One is that, you know, tomorrow morning, I will be giving a talk for the Unitarian Universalist of San Francisco. It's also, which is that, you can find it on their website or in IndieBay. It'll be a simultaneous Zoom broadcast. It's 9:30 tomorrow. I'll be talking about what to expect in under the Trump administration and kind of analysis of U.S. foreign policy, elaborating on some of the things that we've already discussed here today. I also want to plug a talk on Monday, November 18th at 4 p.m. at the University of San Francisco. Dr. Syed Atshan, who is a Palestinian who got his PhD at Harvard some years ago. He's now the head of the Peace and Conflict Studies program at Swarthmore College, the premier peace studies program in the country. And he'll be giving a talk, again, 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon, the 18th, on Gaza, a queer feminist perspective. So Gaza, a queer feminist perspective, the University of San Francisco, on the afternoon of the 18th.
Are these events posted on your website?
No, I don't think they have. My work website is still being reconstructed. Okay. But you can find the USF talk on upcoming events at the University of San Francisco, at usfca.edu. And again, IndieBay or the Unitarian Universalist of San Francisco, UUSF, website should have that information as well.
Yeah, I want to also go back to one point that I didn't make about North Gaza. As far as I know, no aid, zero aid has been allowed in for several months. We're talking about a few hundred thousand Palestinians without access to any food, without access to, you know, just hardly any health care in terms of the hospitals barely functioning, and relentless essential carpet bombing of that area. So the point about UNRWA being possibly. You know, shut down, right now, no aid at all is coming in to North Gaza. And, people are starving or being just killed by, you know, U.S. bombs overhead. You wrote a piece, or you I don't know if this was a talk or something that you wrote about anti-Semitism in the pro-Palestinian movement, what's real, what's not, why it matters. Why don't you discuss that? Because anti-Semitism, I went to Hebrew school, Stephen. I mean, I went to Hebrew school from the time I was like 7 or 8 years old to the time I was like 15 or 16. And I was fed a whole lot of false narratives, but I understood what anti-Semitism was. That I was taught, I think, properly. And it is turned completely on its head since the IHRA definition has taken off.
Yeah, so I addressed this in this article I've been working on, presentations and the like, that, and I think your listeners are familiar with the weaponization of anti-Semitism and this McCarthyistic uses. And I've written a number of articles actually on the looking specifically at issues of academic freedom and the abuse of Title VI civil rights legislation, you know, to target unfairly pro-Palestinian activists. What I do address in presentation, though, is that this is a widespread phenomenon, and I talk about how, you know, River to the Sea is not about the destruction of physical destruction of Jews or expulsion or anything like that. I talk about how Intifada, simply the Arabic word for shaking off. I go down and look at all these false charges of anti-Semitism and analyze them. But I also emphasize we should be very careful not to fall into a crying wolf phenomenon, and to recognize when there really is anti-Semitism within the movement. And I talk about how, you know, anti-Semitism, like racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, you know, are all ubiquitous in our society. And just as we would not tolerate, you know, racist or sexist activities within our popular movements, we should have the same level of intolerance around anti-Semitism. But I also emphasize that, like other forms of oppression, you know, some of it's subtle, some of it's what some people would call microaggressions, and I look at how certain things will parallel anti-Semitic stereotypes. You know, I emphasize, for example, you know, that you know, exaggerating the power of AIPAC or the Zionist lobby. I mean, obviously they have a lot of influence. I've been targeted. I've been on their hit list of, you know, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic professors. I've had talks canceled. You know, I know they're out there. I know they have the influence, but I basically make the argument that the U.S. has supported far-right regimes engaging in genocide for decades. You know, everything from the Guatemalan junta to the indigenous peoples to Indonesia, East Timor, Turkey, and Kurdistan. I mean, the Pakistan, Bangladesh. I mean, there have been other genocides the U.S. has supported. And I go through other aspects of how we need to look at our policy, not in terms of exaggerating that. This is the idea that somehow the United States would have a foreign policy in the Middle East consistent with human rights and international law if it weren't for a rich cabal of Jews forcing our hand. And the fact is, we haven't had that kind of benign foreign policy anywhere. We should recognize that people making the policies are overwhelmingly Gentiles who do it for their ideological or strategic or other kind of interest, and they're not the puppets of wealthy Jews. I mean, there's nothing anti-Semitic about condemning Zionism, but if you use the word Zionist, like the word Jew, in terms of Zionist control of the bank, Zionist control of the government, the Zionist control, you know, of finance, or, you know, what, you know, that kind of thing. Definitely, even if you don't say the word Jew, you're clearly just, you know, repeating the old anti-Semitic canards.
Stephen, can you, I think one of the problems is anti-Zionism, Zionism, these definitions are not fixed anymore. My parents' mm-hmm. generation of Zionism is not the same definition of Zionism yeah. that Itamar Ben-Gvir has, or Bezalel Smotrich, or David.
Exactly,
Friedman.
I talk about that as well, actually, because the thing is that, you know, it's fine to be anti-Zionist. It's fine to say, okay, no form of Zionism is legitimate. That whatever emancipatory impact Zionism may have had for some Jews, it does not make up for the the dispossession and the genocide and the everything else that has followed. And it's fine to see it as a colonial enterprise from the get-go, but at the same time, it's wrong to see Zionism as a monolith. It's wrong to see Zionism as only its worst, most explicit, most racist and militaristic aspects. And that there are some, Zionists who consider themselves liberals who can be allies in stopping the war and stopping the settlements and things like that. So, again, nothing anti-Zionist about them. Anti-Semitic, nothing anti-Semitic about opposing Zionism as a whole, but it really would be unfair to not recognize there is diversity, within Zionism and has been from the very beginning.
So would you say that there isn't a definition really of what it means to be a Zionist or what it means to be an anti-Semite?
I use, when someone asks me, what's my view of Zionism, the first thing I say is, define Zionism. Because it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. I don't think I'm a Zionist by most definitions, but still I think it's important to specify exactly what one means. And tactically, strategically, I'm one of those who believes that given what's at stake here, we it's probably more in building allies and changing U.S. policy. We need to focus more on basic things like international and human rights, that most Americans already agree on, and try to avoid getting in big divisive ideological battles about the nature of Zionism.
During Trump's first term, he adopted the IHRA definition, right? Is that still what?
The Biden administration redefined it. And anti-Semitism in a way that was broader than I think you or me or most of our listeners would like, but wasn't as bad as the IHRA. It did give many of us were relieved actually, but with Trump back in, he's very likely going to he's promised to crack down on protesters. He's promised to deport non-citizens who take part in pro-Palestinian protests. He and his congressional allies and then control both houses of Congress have declared that they will deny federal funding to colleges and universities that don't crack down on pro-Palestinian protests. So this is going to be a big battle coming up. And it'll be very interesting to see if the college administrators cower like they did to the congressional committees this spring, or whether seeing academic freedom under attack, that they will be part of the resistance along with civil libertarians and others.
And what's your relationship like with the higher ups at the University of San Francisco?
Well, USF is a Jesuit school, and that there's a strong tradition of social justice. And a lot of concern and very strong programs in terms of that with international ties. My department's been very supportive of me. The College of Arts and Sciences has been very supportive of me. The previous administrations have gone out of their way to defend me when I've been attacked, both within and from without the university. We're in a transition right now in terms of an administration. The most immediate outgoing president signed a pretty hardline statement immediately after October 7th, at this point, many of us, and he's insisting on enforcing a no camping policy that was reinstigated after the protests this spring. But there's been no threat in terms of my academic freedom, and we also have a very strong union at my university. So I think I'm in much better shape than folks are at a lot of places. I recently resumed my role as chair of the director of the Middle Eastern Studies program. We've gotten support from our college to get a full a professor to teach Palestine studies. We have several classes on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Within this talk, looks at the history and culture of Palestine. That was a student demand.
That's the first. That's the first time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, and we another student demand. Arabic was language instruction was cut for financial reasons a couple years ago, but we're bringing it back. So you know, there's a lot of there. So we are getting some more in support, more and more support, which is really good. And also funding the speaker series, such as the one I mentioned with Professor Achan a week from Monday.
Our guest on Gaza Corner is Dr. Stephen Zunis, who's the professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco and served as the founding director of the program in Middle Eastern Studies and recognized as one of the country's leading scholars on U.S. and Middle East policy. In the 2 minutes we have left, maybe we can have a hopeful angle, because we've seen one of the greatest surges in activism and awareness of the genocide in Gaza and what's going on in the West Bank and Lebanon. This would have been unimaginable just a couple of years ago. Yeah. So does that give you hope for the future?
I am old enough to remember how movements, you know, have shifted U.S. policy. And from, you know, obviously the Vietnam War and the intervention in Central America to sanctions against South African apartheid, freedom for East Timor. And I really do see this movement gaining support. And there's always a big gap between the shifts in public opinion and changes in policy, but especially in foreign policy. But it has happened repeatedly. And the biggest shift is terms of age. I don't know any issue, even LGBTQ issues, where there's such a straight line in terms of age and political attitude. Younger people are much more pro-Palestinian. And that older generation, Biden's generation, is dying off. And so we will definitely see a shift in policy when the people who are now 18 to 35 years old become the people who are actually running the country. And with the shift in U.S. policy, Israel will no longer be able to sustain the kind of horrific things that it's doing. We will see a shift. The only question is how many people die in the meantime.
And if apparently the goal of Netanyahu is to see this as his once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to reshape the map of the Middle East so that it is more favorable to Israel, which, you know, I used to think that is just, you know, a pipe dream, but who knows?
Yeah.
I want to thank you for being on Gaza Corner tonight, Stephen. I really, really appreciate it, and I know our listeners do also.
Thank you so much. It was really good talking with you.
All right. This is KALW, a San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Dory Stein, and that was Dr. Stephen Zunis. I'll be back again next Saturday night from 9 to midnight with Tangents and Gaza Corner from 11 to midnight right here on KALW.